Committee on Revenue for February 13th, 2007 will come to order. Let me say first, welcome Senator Brad Avakian to sit with the panel today. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you letting me sit in with you.
You're very welcome. Okay, great. And I wanted to announce first that we will not be holding work sessions today on House Bills 2211 and House Bill 2212. So anyone who's here for those will be scheduled on another day, and we apologize if there's any inconvenience. We will open now a public hearing on House Bill 2210. Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2210 does a number of things. It extends income and corporate excise tax credits for agricultural producers and collectors of biofuel raw materials, including forest or agriculture-sourced woody biomass, oilseed crops, grain crops, grass, or wheat straw and animal rendering byproducts used to produce fuel in Oregon. It also allows personal income tax credits for the purchases of fuel blends for use in an alternative fuel vehicle, solid biofuel that contains 100% biomass, and biodiesel for home heating at 20% concentration of biodiesel. It declares facilities used to collect or store biomass or to produce biofuel as eligible for a property tax exemption. It creates standards for biodiesel and ethanol to be monitored by the Oregon Department of Agriculture. It requires the Oregon Department of Agriculture to monitor biodiesel fuel production and ethanol production capacity in Oregon to initiate minimum fuel blending requirements statewide for biodiesel fuel and ethanol. It requires retail sellers of gasoline to sell only gasoline that contains at least 10% ethanol within 3 months after Oregon production of ethanol reaches 40 million gallons per year. It requires retail sellers of diesel to sell only diesel that contains at least 2% biodiesel within 3 months after production of biodiesel in the state reaches 5 million gallons annualized for at least 3 months. It requires retail sellers of diesel to sell only diesel that contains at least 5% biodiesel within 3 months after production of biodiesel in the state reaches 15 million gallons annualized for 3 months. It excludes diesel fuel sold for use by locomotives. It restricts the proportion of methyl tertiary butyl ether and other gasoline additives. It requires state-owned structures to use biofuel or direct application electricity generated from biofuel where diesel is currently used for stationary or backup generation. You also have some preliminary revenue impact numbers. There are a number of amendments in the works, so there isn't an official revenue impact statement, but there is a table titled HB 2210 Preliminary Revenue Impact that shows some draft numbers for the impact of the property tax exemption and the production credits and consumer credits.
Thank you. Any questions for Chris?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Butler.
I'm sure we'll get into it. My concern would be the mandates, and obviously the concern would be there that when you have annualized production, and I guess that would be known on an annual basis, if that production is actually produced in Oregon, but there's a larger demand out of state, what's the consideration there? And secondly, while it exempts fuel used by locomotives, I think probably the larger amount of diesel is actually probably used in shipping in this state. Is there any exemption there? And I'm thinking of shipping via the ports.
Currently, there is no exemption. Exemption.
All right. We have with us today the chair of the Environment Committee, Representative Dingfelder, who we've asked to make an opening statement, and I think you brought someone with you to also make a presentation. Representative, if you would proceed, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I'm State Representative Jackie Dingfelder, House District 45, and also Chair of the Energy Environment Committee. Appreciate you inviting me up here, and I've asked the Department of Energy and the Governor's Office to be here because we've been working very closely with both of these entities to hopefully get the best bill we can to you. As you know, we met for 2.5 days. We had public hearings for 2.5 days on this bill, and I really appreciate the fact that your committee was there for 2 of the days. So I don't think I have to go into too much of the background because you actually heard the majority of the testimony in the public hearing. We did have a very intense work session. This folder is the amendments and all the information that went behind the amendments. And I think that what you have in front of you is a very good product. We still have some minor technical fixes that need to happen. Those are in Legislative Council. And first I want to just walk you through a little bit of the changes through the Dash 5. I don't want to go into too much detail, but basically we worked with pretty much every stakeholder on to get to the Dash 5s. And we had, as your staff has already mentioned, we had some changes almost in every section. And the reason that the Dash 5 looks like a new bill is because, and I had requested to LC that they redraft because I thought it would just be too onerous to try with all the amendments to fit them together. So although some people are calling this a gut and stuff, it is not a gut and stuff. It is a rewrite, so it's easier for all of us to read through the bill. And that's, you should have the Dash 5s in front of you. Is that correct?
No.
Okay.
We have something called House Amendments to House Bill 2210.
Okay, and that's the engrossed version of the Dash 5.
Yes.
Is what you have.
Thank
so you are, actually, I don't have, I still only have the Dash 5. So
do you have an engrossed?
The question is, would it be helpful for us to walk you through the different sections so you know?
I think it would be beneficial to walk through the pieces, especially the parts that have changed. And
okay.
Committee, let me say that what I have in my hand is House Amendments to House Bill 2210, which I understand are the Dash 5s, in engrossed form. And in addition to that, the engrossed House Bill 2210, which is the same thing without the amendment notations.
Okay. Right.
So if you have the engrossed version of the bill, you have the bill that she's talking about.
And okay? We'll walk through the engrossed. And before we do that, I want to thank all the stakeholders and the agencies that have been an integral part of this process. We have worked with pretty much everybody from the petroleum industry, the alternative petroleum industry, the ethanol and biodiesel folks, the Farm Bureau. We've worked with the producers. We've worked with pretty much every stakeholder group that has come forward and had some very constructive input into the bill. I also want to thank the Department of Agriculture, who has worked tirelessly on the testing standards, and, of course, the Department of Energy, who has really been there to help us address concerns all along the way, and the governor's office. So I would be remiss if I did not also thank Legislative Council, who has done an incredible job in turning around some very complicated language in a very short time, and we certainly appreciate that given the high workload that they have. The bill isn't perfect, and that's one of the reasons we're here, is to tell you that there's some other technical fixes on the policy side. I'm not here. You guys are the experts on revenue, and we certainly can answer any questions on that, but you see we left it blank purposely, so you would be able to fill in those producer tax credits. So with that, I'm going to ask David Bantoff from the governor's office and Mike Graney if we can start walking through the engrossed version.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Bantoff from the governor's office for the record. And just to clarify, Mr. Chair, would you like us to touch the kind of key elements of the overall bill, or try and just focus on changes? No, it's off. Focus on changes to the bill since the Dash 5s.
We of course were here for the public hearing on the earlier version of the bill. I think it's most important for us to talk about the changes.
Okay.
And then committee members may have questions.
Okay. And some of the Mr. Chair, some of the changes that we'll go through have gone back and forth from either the very first version of the bill to where we're at with the engrossed. Sorry for the buzzing. Stop my cell phone.
It's probably me. I just turned off the radio on my cell phone, and if other people have the radio on their cell phone on, you might want to turn it off now.
Some of the issues that came up after the Dash 5s were included the definition of biomass under the bill, and we had...
That's under Section 2.
Under Section 2.
Line 14.
Yeah, can I have it engrossed over here? line 14, there had been a couple of sections talking about diameter size that had been added to the bill. Those were removed. There was also a request to clarify that at line 16, the sub A there, that would include rangelands, managing rangelands for ecological health as well as forest lands. So that's going to be added to the bill under amendment.
And Mr. Chair, some of these are very technical. If you want us to go into the detail, we are more than happy to, but we don't want to bog down.
Well, that looks
committee.
Like a drafting error, that one.
Yeah, it had rangeland initially, and then it didn't have rangeland in a second. They wanted to make sure it was clear that applied to rangelands. In addition, there's a new section being added that'll make it clear that woody, hardwoods that are grown, cultivated for harvest purposes on private lands will qualify.
As poplars.
Poplar. the rangeland gets to the juniper issue as well.
Just trying to Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Will we be expected to amend the A engrossed in this committee, then? Is that what we're saying? Probably we'd ought to have just a little further explanation if we're going to be amending that so that we'll know what is included and what won't be included in the amendments which will come forward from this committee.
I think, Representative Butler, that we're in the process of doing that right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in addition, we don't have the amendments in front of us to kind of walk through line by line. We'll have that, for the work prior to the work session. What we're trying to do today is kind of walk through some of the key issues that are in those amendments, and then if there's further questions when we have them to look at line by line, we can do that as well.
Okay, well, I appreciate the fact that they want to do a high level, but at some point we'll need to do, if we're going to be adopting amendments, we'll need to understand them, how they may affect the revenue.
Well, and we can go over, we can talk about that now. It's just that we don't have, the amendments are not ready yet. We are hoping in the next day or two.
And if you could be available when the amendments are ready, we could walk through those again with the committee at that time.
Thank you.
But I think it's perfectly appropriate to go through and talk about where you see the changes that have already occurred and the changes that need to yet occur.
Okay.
Now. Thank you, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart. So in addition to the definition of biomass that's being slightly amended, the definition of biofuels under the production section, and that...
Just if you can use the sections and lines.
Yeah, I'm looking for... trying to work through the engrossed. So under Section 10, at lines 13, starting at line 13 on page 5 of the engrossed, we had gone to kind of a two-definition format under an A and B, which is in the engrossed here. The amendment will go back to just the A definition of biodiesel, and that is the agreement with the stakeholders. Again, as Representative Dinkfelder noted, the Department of Agriculture worked very hard with the stakeholders to get to a mutual agreement on how to handle that issue. The issue that's involved there is there's a fuel that some of the larger petroleum producers are trying to develop that would be a bio-based fuel. It's not currently defined under any standards, either ASTM standards or the National Weights and Measures standards. And so we're kind of indicated in this legislation that is coming down the road, that type of fuel, the Department of Agriculture will be able to evaluate that fuel once it has gone through the proper testing hoops, including ASTM and National Weights and Measures. But it's not currently; it won't be defined as biodiesel for purposes of the bill. So it's kind of an intermediate position to clarify that we are expecting that to be a fuel down the road.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify that we worked really closely with the Department of Agriculture on this because there's a couple things. First of all, this is a fuel that's going to be put in trucks and cars, and we wanted to make sure that the folks, the truckers and the automobile dealers felt comfortable with the testing standards and the oversight that the ODA currently they provide now for regular petroleum, so this is, we want to make sure it's consistent with all the standards they have, and then for new, any new standards for, especially when you're talking about a higher level of biodiesel going into cars. So that, it's a very technical issue. That's one of the reasons the Department of Agriculture had to be involved in that discussion, and so we worked with the trucking industry, the automobile folks, the petroleum industry, ethanol and biodiesel folks, to make sure that they were all okay with that. So that's the product that you're going to be seeing coming from the amendments.
And while we're on this, I want to recognize Representative Berger, and then I may have a question.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I got a little lost here. In Section 10, the definition of biodiesel, is that where we are? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's my understanding that in the amendments, part of that will be removed, part of the language that is in the existing bill?
Yeah.
And replaced with something? Is that where there's a... You got to alert me where the language is sure to change.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, yes, that's what's going to happen, is the sub B currently at line 16 will be deleted.
Okay, just sub B.
Sub A will stay, and then there will be references to what's going to be called other renewable diesel. In several sections, when you go through the testing and standards.
Okay, thank you. That helps.
Portions.
Yes.
And also, we're going to skip back to Section 9 because we skipped over that. That's a new section.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, and I'm trying to cover the kind of, in terms of magnitude of the issue. So those are the two definition issues. Another change at Section 9, which is on page 4. Both in starting at line 33 and then again at line 40, the responsibility for the jobs study that's provided there is going to be designated to the Department of Energy rather than Economic Development. That was a mutual agreement with the agencies in that Department of Energy has been working on this issue for years and has a lot of technical understanding of both the players and the market.
And, Mr. Chair, this is an entire new section. I absolutely support it wherever we're using public money to look at doing some type of study to show the job creation, and I think all parties thought that was good language to be in there, and hopefully this will be a model for other such bills.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you. And I do commend Representative Dingfelder for encouraging the job study. Other studies, we've looked at the Betsy and the Retsy just briefly the last couple of days, and one of the things that we're talking about there is to make sure that we've got other ascertainable standards and a matrix that we're meeting other goals. Will you do more than just study jobs, or will we actually study production lines, supply lines, the usage, and then the beneficial effects to the economy as well as to the environment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, and for the record, Mike Graney from the Department of Energy. Yes, as we will study more, and as we discussed in terms of benchmarks for the other tax credits yesterday, we also, in the memo I provided to you, had suggested benchmarks for the tax credits that are in this bill as well. They're a little different. They do deal with some of the issues you mentioned in terms of volume of material produced, for example, gasoline displaced, and other criteria, and those are criteria that you can look at, and if we're not capturing everything you want between that and the study here in Section 9, we can certainly look at those other issues as well.
Mr. Chair, I think that would be appropriate, and as long as we have Mr. Graney here, that if they will do the job study, we really need to have some other ascertainable standards that we're developing around this whole process.
Representative Butler, we did get that yesterday.
With regard to the Betsy and Retsy.
Well, yes, but it's in the same memo, if you'll look at it. It might be useful to extract that so it can actually go in the bill file. But if you brought your bill file from House Bill 2211 and House Bill 2212, or 11 and 12, you should find the memo from yesterday, dated February 5th, and that memo has that in it, doesn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you.
And that will be included in the amendments, then?
Representative Butler, our plan at this moment is to include these in one of the documents prepared by staff and then refer to it in our resolutions with the idea in mind that we would then refer it back to the agency for their utilization as a benchmark or as a series of benchmarks and matrices, and to the Department of Revenue for its inclusion in the tax expenditure report for next time. And I think that's probably going to be our plan on all of these, rather than burdening a legislative bill with it. This is very much the system that the Ways and Means Committee uses for agency benchmarks, and I think it's an appropriate one for us to follow on tax credits. It also means that we can be adding these to tax credits that we're not actually considering bills for this time. But anyway, we can have a more general conversation about that later, but I think it's useful for us to be thinking about that as a mechanism for doing it. The disadvantage, of course, is that they don't all go to the floor. The advantage is that they will be useful for as an aid to study for future committees.
And I have asked Mr. Graney to give me a further breakdown of some of the tax credits and so forth that are involved in this process, so that we can start to identify with each tax credit the various items of the folks that will be held responsible, how much they will earn in a tax credit, or we anticipate that they would earn, so that in the overall tax expenditure report that we really know who is responsible for what items of taking care of of our environment. So
well, and thank you, Representative Butler. Some of that, of course, we may need to ask the Department of Revenue for, but they can hopefully develop matrices that will allow us to tease out that material in an appropriate way without greatly increased expenditures in order to get there. I'm getting a smile from Mr. Phillips, so he understands what I'm asking.
He's actually trying to duck.
Mr. Graney, it would be very helpful if you could extract that memo and divide it up so that we can have a piece for each.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman.
Bill would go in the bill folder.
Certainly, I'd be glad to do that.
Thank you. And I've lost track of where we were. I think we're back on the continuing explanation.
Mr. Chair, I'll continue if that's what you'd like. I'll just point out in Section 13 on page 6 in at lines 24 and 29, the version that is in your A and gross will continue to be the version. It's just it had gone back to a different form than prior versions. And it's tied to the gallons produced on an annualized basis over 3 months. The stakeholders and the governor's office and the prior committee agreed was the best standard for triggering the fuel standard. There had been a different iteration prior to that tied to capacity for biodiesel, and this is focusing on annualized production. So in effect, someone will have to produce over a three-month period of time that amount of fuel to trigger the fuel standard, and it will have to be continuous. So if production ceases and after a month, they'd have to start over again in terms of getting to the 3 months of annualized production capacity for production, actual production, sorry. Section 14 on page 7, line 10, sub 4, is going to be amended to expressly note that not only rail but also marine engines and home heating are exempted from the fuel standard.
Okay.
Jumping all the way to section 27, starting on page 9, and then going into page 10, very minor adjustment, but it's going to be clarified that where the reference to 50 cents at line 21, for instance, on page 10, reference may not exceed 50 cents per gallon. It's going to be minorly adjusted to say that it is equal to 50 cents per gallon for clarity in terms of the revenue impacts. The section 35 is kind of the next area where there's some minor amendments around the land use. That's the land use section. And DLCD just notified us of a couple of very technical tweaks to that section. Let me get you a line for that.
I think you recall during the original testimony in my committee that the Farm Bureau Oregon Farm Bureau had brought up some concerns about language. We wanted to make sure that biofuel processing facilities could be located on EFU land and maintain that status. So we worked very closely with DLCD to make sure that the language was consistent. And that's some of the changes that you see. And then we had to make a couple more tweaks. But everybody is comfortable with that language. I know that doesn't have a revenue impact directly in this bill, but certainly as far as EFU status, we wanted to make sure that that was covered.
This is for the purpose of siting facilities on farmland. Thank you.
And then lastly, there, if we can get it into the final amendments that you'll be seeing later in the week, there was agreement to in earlier iterations to remove what was an initial property tax exemption section from the bill. That was in the original bill that was filed. There was agreement amongst the stakeholders to remove that and instead reference a statute, the Rural Renewable Energy Development Zone statute, to clarify that biofuel production facilities qualify for that development zone designation. And so there will be an amendment that will make that happen as well.
It'll be an added new section.
Yes, it'll be an added new section of the bill. Again, assuming we can get these all through the Ledge Council on the timeline.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that we didn't cover section, and I don't know if you want to walk through section 3. Section 3 is really the big section for your committee as far as filling in the blanks. That's the producer tax credits.
That's the one we'd better walk through carefully.
That's the producer tax credits, and we...
Section 3 on page 3.
I'm sorry, section 5, now that everything's being renumbered, page 3. Section 5, and that's the production tax credit, and that we have left for this committee to make those decisions. But I have asked Mr. Vantoff to walk through that, and then we also, do we have Department of Agriculture here?
Mm-hmm.
So they're available also if there's any specific questions. So I don't know if you wanted to take questions on any of the others before we dive into that, though.
Let me ask a couple, but I'll take Representative Butler first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back over to page 7 on lines 10 and 11, have you done any analysis on the shipping in this state relative to railroad locomotives versus ships in the channels? It's my understanding that the ships in the channels use a huge amount of this diesel, and that could be problematic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's one of the amendments that will clarify that not only rail but barge and are exempted from the standard.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand that you'd already considered that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that's what when you use the word marine, that's what you're referring to, isn't
correct.
It?
Correct.
Yes. Thank you. Before we go on, let me just quickly ask, when you say it's been agreed to, I think what you mean by that is that all the stakeholders that you've been able to identify have agreed to the proposed change that you're talking about. And I'm getting head nods. And I think the other question I had is, these issues were vetted in your committee.
Correct.
Although the language didn't actually make it into the bill in time.
Correct. Well, as you know, Mr. Chair, there's a lag in legislative council.
Oh, I'm very aware of that these days.
Yes. And shocking.
Yes.
But so part of it is that we need a little bit of time to work out the language, so that was the reason that we said we're going to move forward and have it here, hopefully ready in time for this committee. But we have been working with all the different stakeholders. So the language that has been submitted to legislative council does have agreement with all the stakeholders that have testified in my committee or has written via email or other ways of contacting us.
And I assume, Madam Chair, that you prefer that the House send the Senate a clean bill.
Correct.
Ready to vote on.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So that's part of what this is all about then, too.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If Representative Dingfelder... thank you, Mr. Chair. If Representative Dingfelder thinks that LC is slow in this process and the uptake, she needs to also consider the time and lag that it will take in agriculture to get the products that are going to be necessary. Because as I meet with my constituents, this morning I had some seed growers come out, and they've got to start growing the seed within the next year in order to supply anything within the next 3 years. So there's a tremendous lag in this whole process. So I just hope that we can strive to start to get in front of this pretty quickly with regard to the agriculturists as well, because you're not talking about standard corn, you're not talking about standard other kinds of biomass, you're talking about specialized crops. And those are being raised, presently none of them are being raised for seed crop. You're going to have at least 1 year and possibly 2 and 3 years of seed crop before you actually start bringing production. So if we think that this is slow in this process here, then turn it over to agriculture, because they're going to be very, very reticent to just move forward with all of this.
Thank you.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Butler, if I could respond, that's a very important point you raise, and it's one of the things that we're careful in crafting this bill to be to tie the fuel standard to the actual production in the fields, so that unlike some other states that have fuel standards that became effective at a date certain, ours is triggered on the biodiesel to actual production that's occurring from Northwest feedstock, so that we are actually seeing that transition in the production capacity.
And Mr. Chair, that's why I've asked Mike Graney from the Department of Energy to help me with the whole gamut of credits here so that we can take a look at those, because you first have to start ratcheting up a complete different end that isn't in the production of the biofuels themselves, and you have to offer those folks a credit and the incentives to come to the table first. Else you don't get, you know, it's layered, and you don't ever get to the top of the pinnacle until you crawl over the bottom layers.
Well, I think that would be a good cue for us to go on to talk about Section 5 and the proposed credits. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if the committee members have a document that shows kind of the various feedstock credit options. No? Okay, so I'll walk through what has been proposed by the Department of Energy. The bill itself sets out in Section 5. How do I get it here?
Do you have any copies?
We can walk through it. We'll see it in a second. Section 5 sets out the various proposed feedstocks that would get incentives for production. And the Department of Energy's recommended, with consultation with the Department of Agriculture and stakeholders, what the recommended incentive per unit would be to help make the market transitions in the various feedstock categories. And I'll go through those briefly if that would be of use, and then we can take some questions. But the first feedstock category was for oilseed crops. Canola is one of the commonly known.
Let me ask a question or two to see if we can, how we can proceed with this. I think that the committee is probably likely to be interested in the issue of how, what sort of level of credit we need in the various areas in order to achieve the results that the Energy and Environment Committee was trying to reach.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way I'd like you to address it, if you can.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I think, correct me if this isn't going the right direction, but what is being proposed is how much per feedstock per unit would get the market penetration, get people to grow the crop. What we don't have is yet a final revenue tag as to what that would total. I think we've got roughly numbers in terms of, we can guess roughly where it's at right now. For oilseed crops, the recommendation is 5 cents a pound would be the incentive.
Mr. Chair, is this a tax credit? Is that what this is a tax credit to the farm producer?
Right. What the bill says is the credit rates for biomass are :1 for oilseed crops, blank per pound, and he's proposing 5 cents.
And that goes to the producer, the agriculture producer. So this would be a farm gate tax credit.
Yes.
Thank you. So, sorry about that.
Go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and then the second category is around woody biomass, and the recommended unit incentive is $10 per green ton there. The third category is grass, wheat straw, and other vegetative biomass, And the recommended incentive is, again, $10 per green ton. The fourth category is around animal manure, and the recommended incentive is $5 per wet ton. Not sure what that looks like, but...
You won't go there.
Sorry.
Yes, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, the woody biomass, $10 per green ton, is that based upon someone delivering the woody biomass to the... To the producer, that's not necessarily, because this could be harvested off of other private lands, could be harvested off of public lands, and that, for that matter.
Correct.
Correct.
So that would be at the producer level, but it would be the deliverer. It would be that, in effect, the person that had a truckload of this, and with 10 tons, then they would be qualified. That trucker would be given a $100 tax credit for that woody biomass delivered to the producer.
I believe that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I think what we're trying to do is clarify what we're actually going to be paying for.
Right. And we have pages and pages of assumptions here, which we will hopefully be able to make available to you, because that's how Department of Agriculture and Department of Energy came up with these numbers.
I think that would be very helpful.
These are in draft form, so can we make sure that we get the final?
Mr. Chairman, I think we have delivered those to your staff, so you do have the latest version, but we can make copies for the committee.
Yes, I can send those to the committee. Those were the basis for the revenue impact numbers that are in this table, and I've just been working through those today.
Okay.
So you have some detail, Chris?
Yes.
Backup detail?
Yes. And I will
right, and that's
the
from the Department of Energy?
Yes, it's from the Department of
with
Energy.
With input from the Department of Agriculture?
Yes.
Right. Okay, I think it would be very valuable for the committee to have that too, so that we could individually review it before the work session.
And your staff has that, so they can make it available.
Yes,
you can do that. Okay,
yes.
Good. Thank you.
Chair,
yes, sir.
I am interested in a mechanical question. This is most when you come down to the wheat and barley and triticale per bushel. That credit, that tax credit per green ton, it would be changed from bushel to green ton, I assume, at that point for those kinds of things. But my concern is this would be grown on contract. If I have contracted with a producer and am prepared to deliver, even though the producer may not be able to accept my production, then
I think, Representative Butler, we're going to hold that question.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and finish this presentation, and then if you have a question remaining at when he's finished, then we'll please raise it again.
Yeah, I'm just concerned about the mechanics of how we do this.
Right, and I appreciate that, and I think we need to get the answers to those questions. But let's finish the answer to the question we're working on here first.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, continuing on, the fifth category is used cooking oil, waste greases, and the incentive recommended is 20 cents per gallon. The next category is rendering offal? I should know how to say that. the incentive there is $5 per wet ton. And the
it's under 9, subsection 9, for animal manure or rendering offal.
Yeah.
Okay, so are those the same numbers?
Mr. Chair, the department broke those out into two categories to better.
So in the amendment, we'll change this language in order to separate them out.
Mr. Chairman, they are the same value.
Oh, the same value. Okay.
We did it for purposes of developing the revenue numbers. We broke it out in separate categories.
I see. Thank you. Go ahead.
The seventh category is yard debris and municipal food waste. And, again, the incentive there is $5 per wet ton.
Number 8.
There's $5.
And the next category is grain crops. And the incentive there is 25 cents per bushel.
And that's number 2. I'm sorry, we're sort of not going in order here.
Mr. Chair, just for my information, what's triticale?
Triticale?
Triticale.
It's a type of grain.
Okay.
Barley grain mix.
Mr. Chairman, and the reason our list isn't tracking the order in the bill is we put these in a priority list because of revenue concerns.
Most important first.
Yes.
Least important last.
Yes.
And that's what your staff has.
All right.
List.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the next category is wastewater biosolids, and the incentive there is $10 per green ton. And lastly, the 10th category is virgin oil alcohol produced from Oregon crops, and that is getting at where you, for instance, if you took canola, the producer of the canola would get an incentive, and then when it's taken to a crushing facility, the crushing facility would get an incentive for the production of the oil off of the canola. And the steps in biodiesel is kind of the grain to crushing to the production facility, and oftentimes the production facility does not do the crushing of the into the oil. So that was a separate incentive, and the recommended incentive there was 20 cents per gallon.
Okay.
And that covers the production incentives that are recommended in terms of the kind of the unit prices. In addition to the production incentives, as you know, the bill has consumer tax credit section, which we can walk through if you like as well.
I think we would, but before we go on to that, could you give us a quick sort of overview of the considerations that the committee used in reaching these numbers? What was the point of these particular numbers?
Yeah, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, again, Mike Graney. The numbers we used were actually developed through the Renewable Energy Working Group. We had a biomass subcommittee that was composed of a number of different both agricultural and forest interests, and also people who are providing waste grease for biodiesel production. These numbers were the levels that they consistently told us was the tipping point to really close the gap and make the difference in production, either production or gathering in the case of waste materials and wood waste. Some of the discussion of those criteria, and they vary for each feedstock, are included in the memo that we provided to your staff.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I would add that those numbers are the best estimate of both DOE, Department of Agriculture, and the agricultural sector as to what will be effective in terms of moving the market. And so I think the collective hope is that if there's balancing to do in terms of revenue, that it would not be in terms of reducing the unit percentages, because there's concerns that if you reduce those, you may get to a point where it doesn't have any effect in terms of really moving the market.
There's a tipping point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you. Representative Berger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so I understand, because this is all sort of... The most popular oilseed crop here for production is this canola, the oilseed one. Would that be the most likely, or the most whatever, however you want to describe it? It's certainly the top of the list here, and then I thought these were put in priority order. So that would be a fair statement. So if you grow that seed crop, your tax credit is 5 cents per pound, correct?
Right.
If you, and maybe this isn't doable, maybe this isn't what happens, but if you then grow it and crush it into and render it into an oil, you would get another 20 cents per gallon on that oil. So it's conceivable that one unit, company, person, or farmer, however you want to describe them, would get both. Am I clear in that? Yeah. I just want to make sure that's what I'm hearing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that is correct. They are different stages of development, and there's different expenses involved, but that is also why we listed the oil production as the last priority on our list. If you have revenue constraints, that's where you could shave.
Okay, thank you for that.
Thank you. Then you wanted, now, Representative Bettler, I don't think we got to your question.
Mr. Chair, I'm just concerned about the mechanics of this, and when we start speaking of for instance, the canola oil, and where it could be spun off in this process, probably I'm thinking now, and the bill excludes palm oil. Palm oil is probably the primo place to get this, but we're also harvesting, as we have mandates in the state of Oregon, you're also harvesting about 10,000 acres of trees somewhere in the Pacific in order to get that palm oil to manufacture this much biomass, biodiesel. But in Israel, they use sunflower seeds much more than they use the canola. Where do we go? And that, I assume that's an oil seed crop, would be sunflower, would be included there, side by side. But it does not produce the same quantity that canola does. Any where this is 5 cents a pound, different growing method, whole different production and harvesting method. Any variation in canola versus sunflower seed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, that answer I'd have to defer to Department of Ag on.
Okay.
But there are likely to be a number of different seed sources, but canola is the one we expect to be the most common. Palm oil is specifically excluded both because of the import issues, but also because of fuel quality issues presented from diesel made from palm oil.
Mr. Chair, my mechanical question then comes back. When I'm delivering my canola oil to the plant, or my canola seed to the producer, is that based upon the cleaned weight? Is this the wholeless weight? You know, at what level? And then when I get ready to deliver it, and I deliver under a contract, whether or not the producer can actually use it, do I still get the credit when I have a slip between the mouth and the cup in the hand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, I think that's one of the things that Department of Revenue, probably with the assistance of Department of Ag, would be able to better define and define by rule if necessary, or at least in their tax guidance.
And so I do have a whole series of issues relative to the clean seed versus the field run and those kinds of questions that I'm sure they do have an answer for it. Maybe it's only based upon the actual pounds that they grind and use. Not delivered even under contract. My concern is that if you're trying to promote agriculture in this process with a tax credit, that in fact that they do get the tax credit after they have incurred the expense of buying the seed, planting, production and harvest of the crop, that they would still be entitled to it if for no fault of their own the market had gone south and the producer just says I just can't accept any more of the canola oil even though I have it under contract to take it, and maybe they take it under contract and can't really produce it for whatever reason. So yeah,
thank you, Representative. He's raised a number of interesting questions, and maybe perhaps a way of getting at that might be to say did these issues come up in the other committee? They did not. I think they are ones that are probably appropriate for this committee to deal with,
Mr. Chair, because
they do directly relate to the tax credit.
Yeah, the Department of Agriculture can probably best address it. We did not get in because we didn't set the dollar. I mean, this is recommendations from the Department of Energy and Department of Ag. We did not have these discussions because we knew that this was going to occur in this committee. So that's why we left them blank. Mm-hmm. And I certainly would ask the Department of Agriculture if they'd have these discussions. And hopefully somebody is here. Brent?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brent Searle with Oregon Department of Agriculture. Representative Butler, good questions. I think a lot of those will be worked out by contract. There's some discussion in terms of the credit whether the producer has to sell the seed to an Oregon processing facility. The language of the bill does imply that. And I think your question is if for some reason that facility can't take the crop and he has to sell the Washington facility, do they still get the credit? I guess that's a policy question. Again, I think I would agree that the costs for the grower have been sunk in the crop and probably still should qualify for the credit if it's sold in maybe the region. The way the bill is worded is that the renewable fuel standard is triggered by crop production from the Northwest.
Right.
So conceivably, the product could still be sold in that same area and get the credit, but would be one way to approach it. On the other hand, you don't want to be providing a lot of credits to growers to ship the crop out of state somewhere else. So it's kind of a balancing act there, I think, you have to deal with.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since Mr. Cyril is here, I just wanted to note that the 5 cents per pound for canola is a rather substantial incentive to grow. And as Representative Berger just pointed out a minute ago, it is one of the primary oilseed crops. And unfortunately, because of some rulings from the Department of Agriculture, people in my district are prevented from growing canola. We've been lumped in with the Willamette Valley. And frankly, there are very few people in my district that would consider themselves as living in the Willamette Valley. We've been very patient over a good long number of years waiting for this to be rectified. And I suspect along with the financial incentive, there's going to be another incentive that's coming along very shortly, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Was that a question or
a comment? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Point taken.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, and again, while we have Brent here, I'm going to take advantage of this for just a moment, if I may. And that is, I wonder how much consideration there has been given to the fact that when we're talking about extracting ethanol, and that's part of what we're doing here, one of the probably the very primo crops that we grow here in the Northwest for extraction of ethanol is the sugar beet. And we're limited on the amount of sugar beets that we can grow because of contracts and those kinds of things, but I think there's certainly an opportunity for us to get back into the sugar beet on behalf of the ethanol industry, which could put a tremendous amount of sugar into the ethanol production operations. Is there any discussion in the Department of Agriculture what may happen if you move so much over a very short period of time, so much effort and intense issue of the farmland, which is available to us today in the Northwest, into ethanol production? Is there a possibility that you could interrupt food supply of anything else or increase the cost of the basic food supplies to other folks who would need that farmland for growing sugar beets for sugar versus sugar beets for ethanol? And I'm not just talking about sugar beets now. I'm talking about the whole range of potatoes. Potatoes are a wonderful place for starch, a wonderful opportunity for us to extract the starch energy conversion there. So what discussions have been held at the Department of Agriculture to vouchsafe the food supply for the Northwest?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's a question that's kind of making the rounds at the federal and national, international levels, as well as kind of this food versus fuel discussion. But I think in terms of those other crops that you brought up, the economics are substantially different. Most of the production of ethanol now is corn-based. Sugar beets are substantially more expensive to convert. They're substantially more expensive to try to store. I mean, you've got to have a feedstock through the entire year, and sugar beets don't store through the summer very well. So those kinds of things would probably not go into ethanol in a large way. I don't think those kinds of impacts would happen in terms of food crops. I mean, I'd be glad to provide, and we can have a more lengthy discussion on this topic. It gets rather detailed, but my perspective is, in the short term, those things or the food concern is not as big as some would portray it to be.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the fact that Mr. Searle is willing to talk about this privately. I'd like to have it on the record. The Department of Agriculture is as concerned about any kinds of interruptions in the food supply or any kind of a price hike in the food supply because of some of the demands for the same kinds of crops on the limited amount of growing potential that we have in the Northwest under our present agricultural schemes.
Thank you. Answer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. Again, I think in the short term, what's going to go into ethanol is corn. And the production is going to react there in the Midwest. They're going to increase corn acres. That's probably going to displace soybeans to some degree. In terms of the impact in Oregon, what we grow here is so diverse. There isn't going to be large displacements. The incentives in this bill as proposed to you are not going to create huge shifts in production. Production of canola, for example, and displacing wheat would actually be a good rotational crop. They're looking for rotational crops. It can be beneficial in that way, as well as hopefully at some point with grass seed, if we can get that dilemma worked out in the Willamette Valley as well.
So. And, Mr. Chair, if I may add, also we haven't really had much of a discussion about cellulosic ethanol, which is on the verge of being commercially based, but right now we are not able to produce that. My understanding, there's two different ways of producing that, and neither of them are available yet at a commercial level. And so I think what we're going to see initially in all the reading and research that I've done is we probably are going to see initially corn-based ethanol that will transition to cellulosic ethanol over time. We do have a couple folks here from ethanol that are about to embark on opening up ethanol plant in Port of Morrow, and certainly we can ask them to come up, and because I'm not the expert on that, but that's a lot that I've been reading is that it's probably going to be just a few years out before we'll be looking at, you know, cellulose, which wouldn't necessarily displace food crops.
Mm-hmm. And, Mr. Chair, my concern also is that when we talk about corn, you just don't talk about corn. As Mr. Sherrill could probably tell you, there's probably thousands and maybe tens of thousands of varieties of corn, and some of them are wholly unsuitable for this kind of production, or for this kind of ethanol and alcohol production. And others, while they may be suitable, cannot be grown in the Northwest. Mm-hmm. So my concern is that, and I share the concern that Representative Witt has expressed today, that there are certain areas in this state, because of boundary and concern of crossover of cross-pollination, that you can't grow some of these various kinds of crops, the most efficacious with regard to the extraction of the oils. Some areas are just precluded from doing it, and I am concerned about that, but I'm also concerned that...
Thank you, Representative. Fortunately, this committee's main focus is going to be the tax credits, so we'll leave the Department of Agriculture and the agricultural community to figure out the answer to the question that you're raising now. I think we probably need to go on, if we're going to get finished today, with the section on consumer credits and whatever other comments you have about the engrossed version of the bill. And I think, given the time, I'd ask the committee to hold questions until we're finished with that portion. I appreciate that.
Section 26. If you want to start with the biofuel consumer income tax credits, that's section 26, page 9.
Mr. Chair, yeah, as Representative Dinkfelder noted, section starting at section 26 is the consumer income tax credit section. There haven't been any changes to this section proposed in the latest set of amendments. And what it provides is incentives for consumers of ethanol and biodiesel using it in their vehicles or using it for home heating oil to get income tax credits that are capped at $200 per year. It's likely there's also a unit price of 50 cents per gallon. But it's likely that people that use the fuel on any kind of a regular basis are going to reach the cap, the $200 cap. And I think the revenue estimates for this are in the range of
this is for 0709.
This is the revenue. So the graph that was provided by staff have it at under $1 million. Around $900,000.
That's for both home heating and vehicle fuel usage. So I don't know if you want to describe about the home heating.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The home heating is two things. One is for highly efficient, high-density wood pellet stoves that burn much cleaner than normal wood stoves, and then for biodiesel use of B20 as home heating oil. And again, you have the $200 limit,
also, as far as the fuel, just a clarification that we're looking at B99
for transportation.
So this is an incentive. In essence, this is an incentive for using a higher level of a blend of fuel, whether it's biodiesel at B99. I think the ethanol is at E85. So this is to incent a consumer and reward a consumer who is going to help boost the market by using a higher level of blend, whether it's home heating or in their car or a more energy efficient stove. And it's relatively small. We don't see a B99 is a pretty small part of the market, but we wanted to provide incentives for folks that are going to take that extra step and use that higher level of biofuels.
And Mr. Chair, I would add just for reference for the committee that comparing it to the fuel standards that were provided for in the bill, that B99 and 99% blend of biodiesel would be compared to a B2 and or a B5 fuel standard of 2% or 5% blended biodiesel. So it's a very large step up. And similarly, the 85% ethanol provided for under the consumer credit is much higher than the 10% blending that would be required under the fuel standard.
So that's it, a relatively simple little bill.
Thank you. So you finished your explanation? One of the Representative Butler, why don't you ask your question in just that language?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Relative to wood pellets for home heating fuel, a cost of $900,000 in the next 2 biennium, why are we considering a tax credit for consumers for an alternative fuel, which consumers are already waiting in line to buy?
Mm-hmm.
What's the incentive there?
It's not $900,000. That's for the total.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Butler, the $900,000 is for the total of all four.
Biodiesel, pellets, ethanol, and biodiesel.
So I'm looking at the next 2 years, $300,000 and
$600,000. Okay, I see. Well, it's true that currently we do have a shortage. I mean, those fuel supplies periodically rise or fall in terms of supply availability. This is a new technology. The wood stoves that are also would qualify for the tax credit or high efficiency, and these wood pellets only operate in those wood stoves. This isn't just your average wood stove. So we think it's worth the tax credit because of that, because of the energy efficiency advantages and the if you're going to burn with wood, the pollution reduction advantages.
Thank you. Yes,
Mr. Chair, I was just going to add, just Representative Butler, the Department of Environmental Quality has looked at that, and they're very supportive of the concept because it will lead to significant air quality improvements, particularly in the air sheds where we're going to have growing problems staying in compliance under the new federal standards that are coming to play. So they think it would be an important tool to try and help shift the market more aggressively towards wood pellets.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, wood stove smoke is still a considerable concern as far as air quality, especially in the Willamette Valley.
Coming from the upper Willamette Valley, I certainly understand and agree with that. I think the representative, if I can try again, I think you asked a slightly different question. And let me rephrase it this way. If, in fact, there is an existing shortage of availability of pellets for those who want to buy them now, why would we additionally incent when we already have a shortage? And I think a partial answer to that might have something to do with trying to encourage further production, but I don't know that for a fact. Would you address that issue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that is true. In fact, we've been contacted by manufacturer of wood pellets that wants to increase production and is looking at our incentives to do that, to help finance the capital expansion of their facilities at a number of different facilities in Oregon. We do expect that supply shortage is going to be short-lived.
Right. So the theory is then that if you reduce the cost to the consumer, you will encourage the producer to make more,
yes,
to invest, yes, in the capital equipment necessary in order to increase production.
That's correct, sir.
Thank you. Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is along the same line. I was contacted by a constituent on this issue who lives in a rural community, doesn't have a lot of money, and they rely on these wood pellets in order to heat their home. It's the only access they have to heating. And their concern was if the tax credit was incenting people to buy more of them, families like this might be less likely to be able to access the one type of fuel that they're able to use to heat their home. And as they checked with wood pellet producers, what they were told was that Oregon is the leading producer of fuel pellets, and it's very difficult for new producers to be able to make it through the regulatory system to get up and going to be able to do those. And I wondered if you had a comment on that and if there was any companion legislation that might ease the administrative burden to further incent manufacturers to be able to produce these.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, in terms of the administrative process, I really can't address that. We don't license those production facilities. We do provide incentives, and the Business Energy Tax Credit, House Bill 2211, the changes there would provide an increased tax credit for manufacturers, including wood pellets as a renewable energy. So that would be of direct benefit to them. And the manufacturer that's been in contact with us recently has talked about the importance of that tax credit, and also using our energy loan program, which provides low-interest loans for financing the capital costs. So we do have some incentives, and 2211 would help improve those incentives for production facilities of wood pellets.
Thank you. Representative Dingfelder needs to move along. Are there any final questions for her before we excuse her? Thank you very much, Representative. We appreciate your coming today and this fairly exhaustive explanation.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair. I appreciate you asking me here, and I will leave the two gentlemen beside me to answer all the remaining tough questions from this committee. But I do appreciate the time and the effort you've taken into this, into reviewing this bill, and you have some tough decisions in front of you, but I am confident that you will do a good job at balancing the policies presented in this bill and the revenue that is necessary to move the biofuels program forward. So I appreciate you inviting me here today, and I will be back whenever you need me.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate your work. Representative Gelser.
Could I just briefly say, since you are the chair of the other committee and you might not congratulate yourself, the effort that you've put into this over such a long period of time to bring together such diverse interests to have a very good bill is just incredible. So I want to thank you personally for your leadership and bringing this to this point where we can really be moving Oregon forward as a leader on these issues.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it, but I would be remiss if I didn't mention there's an army of people behind me, because there's lots of people who are really experts in this issue, and I've been working on this for about the past 3 years, but there's folks who have been working on this for many years, and so there's a lot of people that have been valuable in providing input, and including the two gentlemen up here. Mr. Graney is, whenever I pick up the phone, he's practically in my office before I put the phone down whenever I have questions. So I appreciate all the work the Department of Energy has also done. Thank you.
District 45 is well served.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rosenthal.
Yeah, I just had a question about this preliminary revenue impact statement. Is this a document that you created? This is our staff. So on, but you have a copy of it?
Yes.
On the consumer credit section here, it looks like for everything except for the biodiesel vehicle fuel, the estimates go up from 0709 to the next biennium. But on the biodiesel, the vehicle portion, it stays the same, which seems to me that would be one of the areas that would be the most likely to increase as it became more available. because I know in my neighborhood a lot of people are driving around using biodiesel right now, and it's not very available. So why is that one the same?
Representative Rosenbaum, part of that is the rounding and the numbers there. That particular credit is very used by just a handful of taxpayers currently, so there is some growth in there. It doesn't show up at this level. But right now, my understanding in talking with the Department of Energy is that it's a fairly niche market for people who actually use the biodiesel in their vehicles.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair, I guess that's sort of what I'm getting at is this credit really going to accomplish anything? I mean, it seems like for a lot of people, driving their cars with biodiesel is a value in and of itself, and what's limiting the use of it isn't really the cost as much as the availability of it. That there just aren't very many gas stations where you can get it right now.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, I think the rationale behind the credit there was, in your district, there are a lot of people that are interested in biodiesel, but what you're seeing in the marketplace is most of those folks are using a B20 blend right now. There's very few people using a B99 blend, and what we're hoping to do is incentivize some folks to make that shift either from not using biodiesel all the way to B99, but more likely going from a B20 to a B99. And for those folks, they've kind of already made their decision to go biodiesel when they go to B20. And after that, it becomes in part just a cost question about, you know, how much are they going to pay to put in the fuel. I think most people that use a B20 today would tell you, I prefer to use a B99 if I know that one that it's not going to have any impacts on my fuel use and driving, but two, depending on what the added cost is going to be to do that. So we do think it will have a significant impact. But with that said, the majority of folks that are going to probably utilize biodiesel will stay at a B20, and we don't think you're going to see just a wave of folks jumping to B99.
So follow up, Mr. Chair. I just don't really know very much about this area, but are the two generally available side by side at the same? I mean, are these like two different pumps at the same gas station?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, right now they are not widespread available, and usually there you'll find B20. The few folks that are producing either a B20 or a B99 are trying to meet what the existing market is asking for, and oftentimes you'll find Key Lock and those types of locations for fueling these either a B20 or B99. My understanding, we can ask the biodiesel experts behind us, is that there's only a few stations in Oregon where you could actually put in a B99, and there's significantly more at B20, but still it's a handful of stations where you're able to actually just go and fill up right now. And that's part of what our goal with this overall bill is to do, is to help shift the whole marketplace so there's more demand, there's more opportunity, and you've got the fueling stations starting to shift over to new tanks, because there's costs involved as well. At a B2 level for where it's the standard, or a B5, that would just be blended into the existing infrastructure, into the fuel tanks and everything else. But when you get into B99, that takes dedicated tanks at the service stations, and that's, there's costs, and so it's going to be an incremental growth, we hope.
If I could sort of add to this, the key question for this committee is the type and amount and duration of tax credits. We leave the technical and the practical application issues to the other committees that are experts in those areas. And I have to tell you, as we get further into this, we're further and further afield from the areas that I think the committee should be addressing, although, of course, any member can address any issue. I think it would be helpful for us if we could get a sense, and probably not going to happen today, but if we could get a sense of the considerations behind the credits, what the point of them is. I've got some of them in my head, I suspect, but I think in several questions that we've gotten from this side of the table today, you should have gotten a sense that we wonder whether these credits are really going to be efficacious for the purposes that they appear to be generated. And so if we could have a little more on that issue, I think that might be helpful when we continue the public hearing or meet in work session I think that would add comfort to some of the committee members. Would that be useful?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't think it's just on the two items that we're asked about either. I think it includes other items as well. We talked about pellets. We've now talked about biodiesel. But I think it applies to the others as well. And one of our concerns generally in this committee are the tax credits that we adopt, the ways in which we choose to spend taxpayer money, in effect, actually accomplishing the tasks that we have asked or that we've set out to accomplish. We are asking for these benchmarks that we've talked about earlier to help us with that. But I think we need to understand up front sort of how those are going to be useful. And I don't want to speak for the committee, but I can speak for myself. I'm very interested in encouraging the development of a renewable energy industry in Oregon. That's what I understand this bill is about. But understanding how the tax credit mechanism is, without getting into all the details that the other committee's already dealt with, how that tax credit mechanism actually is going to help us with that, and especially when we've got some committee members who wonder whether the bottleneck isn't something other than the cost. That would be very helpful for us.
Right. And we'll be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. And I might add, too, and I think Representative Rosenbaum's questions, it's a good example. Till last year, members of the public could not buy B99 or E85. Two stations, one in Eugene and one in Portland, opened that are available to the public. There are added costs. And this bill, the tax credits here are... provide some of the pieces to help financing, but also the Business Energy Tax Credit, House Bill 2211, the changes there will help on the infrastructure, the fueling stations, the incremental costs of equipment so that fuel will be available to people when they want to convert to E85 or B99. So it is a package with a number of parts in both bills, and we'll be glad to give you that broader overview of the purpose.
Well, and when you come back, you might want to talk to us, I think I'd appreciate it, at least, if you'd be willing to talk with us about your matrix and how the matrix relates to the issue that we're talking about right now. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, to that end, I have specific questions. It was my understanding that the strategic investment program was something that was going to be added to the bill that is not in there now.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, I think not that program, but the Renewable Energy Development Zone that the Economic Development Department operates, that would be expanded to apply to biofuels as well as electricity.
Is that what you're referring to?
One of the amendments that is in work will be, right now the language refers to a statute which is the Strategic Investment Program. That wasn't the intent. One of the amendments that you'll be seeing changes that reference.
Okay, but that is what you are referring to in your top line.
Yes.
Okay, which is what I'm asking about, which is more information on that, and is that the local government cost that is referenced here?
Yes.
And so,
That goes away.
No.
It does not.
That one does not have a
No,
sense.
It does not go away. It was my understanding. That's what I'd like to know more information about.
Okay.
Because we haven't really talked about that, and that's kind of a big piece, and it impacts local government different than it does state. And so I also, while I'm on this subject, and I've got half a second, when you took out in your proposed amendment any reference to OECDD, that's an OECDD piece more than it is a Department of Energy piece, along with your how many jobs were created is an OECDD piece. So we've got some little things in there that aren't fitting together very well in my mind, and I just mentioned this because, Mr. Chair, you opened the door for me too.
No, and I appreciate it. I'd like to send the floor a clean bill, one that's ready to be passed into law. Did you understand the question, and is either of you prepared to answer it now or come back with further information?
Mr. Chairman, we will come back on this, but the intent was not to include the strategic investment program. It was to reference the other property tax exemption. Now, that will have an impact on local governments, but it's in the form that was the local governments, their representatives preferred that approach.
Okay.
And
so
in terms
more
of
information,
and then in terms of Economic Development Department, they preferred that we do the study rather than they. That's why the switch in the bill for us rather than them.
So, Mr. Chair, the Department of Energy then is prepared to study, including how many jobs are created.
Yeah. Okay. Mr. Chairman, Representative Berger, that's correct. And we've talked with both Economic Development and Employment Department about type of information we would need to try to be able to do that.
Great. Thank you. Further questions for this panel? Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're sending these folks back to research some of this, I am concerned with the mandates, and I think, Dave, you basically touched on it. That is, that there's a rather significant cost of change of infrastructure for our delivery system. My concern is that the mandates under the program could change, that quarterly, as production is up, then there would be a mandate that you must deliver a certain amount of this to retail. And then as the supply goes down at any point, if it should go down, then there's other mandates. And I'm concerned with food prices. I'm concerned with prices of what it's going to cost to implement those mandates at the local level. You do not get the desired result by forcing those folks into a situation where it's uneconomical, in spite of the tax credits that may be offered to them. So I'm just really anxious about what the whole gamut of credits, how they tie together, and then if we've got certain mandates for the use. I mean, when you've got a mandate for the use,
is there a question embedded in that?
Well, there is a question embedded in that, and that is that I would like to know how this all ties back together with the credits, and then whether or not this even whether the vehicle motors. It's my understanding that vehicle motors may use it one day and then not be able to use it the next because you don't have the supply of it. So I'm concerned about the whole process. There's no reason to go down this road and have folks convert for two stations in the state that have the only supplies of it and must assure them a supply to the extent that they've got to go to California or a long distance out, and then you have to truck all of that in using fossil fuels.
Thank you. Was this issue addressed in the other committee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it has been addressed, and I could briefly touch on it.
Give us the short version. Thank you.
Just hopefully to clarify and not make it more confusing, but the 2% 5% blend that would be triggered under the fuel standard, if it's triggered because it requires production, would have, our understanding is, it would have no impact on infrastructure in terms of there would not be added costs in terms of having to have new pumps, new tanks, and the fuel would become standard. It would become the standard blend for the state, so there wouldn't be disruption issues in terms of, is it going to be, you know, 2, 3, 4, or whatever. For the higher levels at B99, that's only a voluntary program, so any person at in the marketplace can make their own decision. Is there a market for selling B99? How much is it going to cost me to put it into my fueling station, and do I want to offer it? But that would not be required of anybody, and it would just be a market-based decision.
But, Mr. Chair, I still have to say I come from a part of the state of Oregon where we do not have the supply lines. The supply line is the Salt Lake City supply line from Standard Oil Company. They produce it in Salt Lake and Sinclair, Wyoming, and move it through the pipeline to Umatilla, where it's blended then off of the barge. So my concern is that much of the fuel that's used in eastern Oregon doesn't originate in Oregon at all. If we're going to have separate fuel standards, you're going to have to go to the Chevron folks in the Standard and Chevron pipeline and work that issue through. So I'd just like to know how it all works. I really do.
Yeah, well, I think it might be useful to have a side conversation on those kinds of questions, because I know they've been all vetted in the earlier committee. Shorten the answer even further, I think the blends you're talking about are so small that they have no noticeable effect on anybody's equipment. So the standard a consumer using this product doesn't necessarily recognize there's any difference from what they were using before. If production declines to the point where you're no longer able to insist on the standard, it would simply reduce, and the consumer again would see no impact on equipment or anything else. That's probably part of the reason why those numbers were chosen, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, we did start at a 2% blend as a really a small step, kind of going towards a fuel standard. The federal numbers that are required for blending are going to exceed what we're doing in Oregon, although they haven't gone to percentages. And yeah, that's precisely why we started at that small level.
Thank you. Further questions for this panel today, recognizing we're obviously having at least one, maybe both of them back again. Thank you very much. Appreciate
Thank you,
it.
Thank you.
I have one other person signed up for today. Two. Let's see how much time we've got. Given the time, I wonder, I've got Tom Endicott and Brian Dougherty. Would it be possible for you gentlemen to return tomorrow? I appreciate that. I've told the committee we're going to try to adjourn at a few minutes, 10 minutes to 3. It's now 10 minutes to 3. I apologize for not getting you in today. We will continue the public hearing tomorrow and hopefully finish it up fairly quickly tomorrow. Thank you very much. We will recess the public hearing and adjourn the committee. Thank you.